Welcome to the audio digest of the American Journal of Psychiatry. This is Dr. Susan Schultz with highlights for August 2017. Our clinical care conference looks at smartphones for self-management in schizophrenia. We'll also review behavioral interventions in buprenorphine maintenance treatment. Two studies looked at aspects of suicidal behavior, completed suicide following self-harm, and the effects of lithium and valproate on suicidal behavior in bipolar disorder. We'll also present several clinical trials. A study of pediatric anxiety disorders compared cognitive behavioral therapy with and without the addition of attention bias modification therapy. Another trial evaluated medication plus CBT for hypochondriasis. And amygdala neurofeedback was tested as a treatment for major depression. The article on neurofeedback has been selected as meriting CME for readers who subscribe to the AJP CME course program. Each month, brief companion exams are created for three articles from the issue. By reading the articles and completing the online exam, individuals can earn up to one AMA PRA Category 1 credit per article. This activity is sponsored by the American Psychiatric Association. To subscribe, click on the CME link at the top of our homepage, ajp.psychiatryonline.org. We'll begin the highlights with our clinical case conference. Smartphone ownership is increasing among patients with serious mental illness. Preliminary research has shown that it's feasible for patients to use smartphones and apps to help manage psychotic symptoms, monitor medications, predict relapse, and improve quality of life. Louis Sandoval and colleagues present the case of a man receiving treatment for schizophrenia who used apps to provide supplemental counseling. The patient tried out numerous apps and found several he liked. In addition to helping him understand his illness and monitor symptoms, the apps taught him cognitive behavioral skills, relaxation techniques, and how to identify social cues and regulate his emotions. Most health apps aren't designed for easy use by persons with serious mental illness. But many patients find that apps are fun. Some are presented in a game-like format. Using apps lets patients be proactive and create their own supplemental treatment plans. Increasing technological literacy will be important for clinicians to help patients make informed decisions about digital psychiatry tools. It's worth routinely asking patients if they're using apps to avoid fragmented care. In addition, many mental health apps provide incorrect information, and patients need to be aware that the data they supply may not be kept private. Some apps market mental health information. Our review article is about the treatment of substance use disorders. Specifically, does adding a behavioral intervention to maintenance buprenorphine treatment improve outcome? Kathleen Carroll and Roger Weiss summarize the research. The review indicates that high-quality medical management may be an adequate level of treatment for many patients. Four influential trials evaluated the impact of adding counseling or other behavioral interventions to buprenorphine with medical management. The adjunctive interventions included enhanced medical management, cognitive behavioral therapy, contingency management, and individual counseling. None of the trials found a difference in opioid use between patients who received the adjunctive intervention and those who didn't. Four other randomized controlled trials indicate that there is some benefit for adjunctive behavioral interventions, primarily contingency management. In one study, contingency management added to brief weekly counseling provided longer sustained abstinence than adjunctive counseling alone. This was true whether the contingency management was delivered by a clinician or a computer. Another study found better retention and longer abstinence from adding a computerized education program to adjunctive contingency management. In a third study, contingency management increased the number of negative urine samples, but only initially, while the value of the reinforcement was rising. The fourth study compared counseling in an opioid treatment program, counseling by a physician in a primary care setting, and CBT. The CBT group had a higher retention rate, but the percentage of negative urine tests did not differ significantly between groups. Now we'll turn to the clinical trial of neurofeedback. New therapeutic approaches are needed for depression. One possibility is amygdala neurofeedback with functional MRI. In depressed people, the amygdala shows exaggerated responses to negative stimuli and blunted responses to positive stimuli. Kimberly Young and colleagues examined the efficacy of real-time functional MRI neurofeedback training to increase the amygdala's hemodynamic response to positive memories in depressed patients. Impaired recall for specific positive memories is an enduring cognitive deficit in depression. Unmedicated adults with major depressive disorder were randomly assigned to receive two sessions of neurofeedback. The experimental group received feedback from the amygdala. The control group got feedback from a parietal region that's not involved in emotional processing. The participants were tested at baseline and again 1 week after the final neurofeedback session. In the experimental group, the hemodynamic response in the amygdala increased relative to baseline and relative to the control group. Response of depressive symptoms was defined as a decrease of at least 50% in the score on the Montgomery-Åsberg scale. The rate of symptom response was higher in the experimental group, 67% versus 13% in the control group. The amygdala neurofeedback training also resulted in an increase in positive specific memories recalled on an autobiographical memory test, with a decrease in overly general memories. The percent of positive specific memories recalled by the experimental group increased relative to baseline and to the control group. Another clinical trial compared interventions for hypochondriasis. Cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, is an established treatment for this disorder, but there hasn't been a lot of research on pharmacotherapy. Brian Fallon and colleagues compared four treatment conditions, placebo, CBT, fluoxetine, and the combination of CBT and fluoxetine. The study included nearly 200 participants. All of them met the DSM-4 criteria for hypochondriasis. The patients were randomly assigned to the four treatments. CBT was given in 6 weekly sessions, followed by 2 biweekly and then 3 monthly sessions. Fluoxetine was given in a fixed, flexible regimen with increases up to 80 milligrams a day as needed and tolerated. The primary outcome measure was the rate of response at 24 weeks, defined as improvements of 25% in scores on 2 ratings of hypochondriacal symptoms. The rate of response in the placebo group was 30%. For the groups receiving CBT, fluoxetine, and combined treatment, the rates ranged from 40 to 47%, but the differences from placebo did not reach statistical significance. On the other hand, in secondary analyses of scores on the Whiteley Index of Hypochondriasis, fluoxetine was more effective than placebo, and it produced significantly faster improvement. It also showed significant advantages over placebo in anxiety scores and quality of life. The next study is about prediction of suicide. Deliberate self-harm is a risk factor for subsequent suicide. But of the people who deliberately hurt themselves, who has the highest suicide risk? The low base rate makes it difficult to evaluate suicide risk over periods shorter than a year. Mark Olson and colleagues used data from the Medicaid program to provide a larger pool of patients with self-harm events. The study covered 7 years of national Medicaid data and included more than 60,000 patients with a diagnosis of deliberate self-harm. The National Death Index was used to identify suicides among this cohort over the year following the index self-harm event. The rate of suicide in the cohort was 37 times higher than in the general population. The risk was higher in people who'd used violent means in the initial self-harm incident, especially those who used firearms. But the higher risk among those who used violent means was present only during the first month after the initial event. After that, it was similar to the risk in people who used nonviolent means of self-harm. To a smaller extent, the risk of suicide was also related to being male, older, or white. The absolute risk of suicide in the year following self-harm was low, but self-harm was likely to be repeated. Approximately 20% of the cohort had another self-harm event during the following year. Another clinical trial tested complementary treatments for pediatric anxiety disorders. It was designed to address different aspects of neural threat processing. Attention bias modification therapy may target rapid, implicit threat reactions, whereas cognitive behavioral therapy may target slowly deployed threat responses. Lauren White and colleagues compared CBT alone to CBT plus attention bias modification therapy. The study participants were 8 to 17 years old and had a diagnosis of generalized anxiety disorder, social anxiety disorder, and/or separation anxiety disorder. Before treatment, they were compared with a healthy comparison group on brain functioning while performing a task involving attention to threats. The patient and comparison groups differed in connectivity between the amygdala and insula. The patients were then randomly assigned to receive CBT paired with either active or placebo attention bias modification therapy. The attention bias treatment used a series of pictures of angry and neutral faces. Active treatment was designed to draw attention away from the threatening faces. CBT produced marked decreases in anxiety across both groups. However, the group that received CBT plus attention bias modification therapy had lower anxiety ratings after treatment. On a categorical measure of improvement, there was no difference between groups. The poorest response to treatment was among the patients whose pre-treatment connectivity profiles were most different from those of the healthy comparison group. This was especially true for the patients who received CBT plus placebo attention bias treatment. We'll conclude with a comparison of lithium and valproate and how they affect suicidal behavior. It's been suggested that lithium has an anti-suicide effect, but the studies have been limited by the rarity of the event and the selected populations. Gisong and colleagues used population registers to conduct an observational study comparing patients with themselves during medicated and non-medicated periods. A Swedish cohort of more than 50,000 patients with bipolar disorder were tracked over 8 years of follow-up. Data were obtained by linking multiple national registers. The risk of suicide-related behaviors during periods of lithium or valproate treatment was compared with the risk during non-treated periods. Patients treated with lithium had a 14% lower risk of suicidal behavior during periods when they were taking lithium than other times. There was no such effect of valproate, and the difference between the two treatments was significant. The risk of suicidal behavior for patients taking both drugs was similar to that for those taking lithium only. This concludes our audio highlights of the August issue of the American Journal of Psychiatry. Please visit our website, hap.psychiatryonline.org, for the complete versions of these and other articles. We also welcome comments. They can be emailed to hap@psych.org. Next month, our topics will include challenges in treating undocumented immigrants, long-term effects of antipsychotics in schizophrenia, a genome-wide association study of anorexia nervosa, factors in medical students' choice of psychiatry, and the relation of medication for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder to substance-related problems. We hope you'll join us. Thank you for listening.